Прошу вас, спасибо. И добрый день. Да? This is my third chance to visit this university. It's always a great pleasure to be here. This occasion, however, is special for a couple of reasons. The first is that this is my first opportunity to be able to speak with the students and to engage you a bit. And the second is that it is also, in the other occasions, it was the month of May, so this is my first chance to experience the normal weather of St. Petersburg. I have to say, it is not difficult to accept invitations to come here at any season. This is a marvelous and beautiful city, as you know, and at one time I only knew it through the novels of Andreev Bely. But in real life, it has even more mystery and attractions. This year, at the St. Petersburg Economic Congress, and also at the meetings of the Free Economic Society, which will be tomorrow in Moscow, and for part also of the Moscow Economic Forum, the discussions have been dedicated to the 50th anniversary of the publication of one of my father's books, The New Industrial State. It was his largest and most significant work of economics. I want to talk about that here today. It was the second part of a trilogy that began with the publication of a book called The Affluent Society in 1958, a book that is dedicated to me. I was 6 years old at the time. And the trilogy closed with a book called Economics and the Public Purpose in 1973. But its pinnacle was The New Industrial State in 1967. Yesterday at the meetings in town, one of the professors who spoke said that this anniversary should be celebrated alongside the 150th anniversary of the publication of Das Kapital, and the 100th anniversary of the storming of the Winter Palace. I thought that was maybe a bit much. Well, my father would have liked it a great deal, I can tell you that. But it was his intention with this book to provoke an economic revolution, a revolution in economic thought. And as he said, all revolutions consist of kicking in a rotten door. The rotten door that he felt he could kick in 1967 was the rotten door of neoclassical or so-called free market, or what we now call neoliberal economics. That doctrine, that dogma of economic theory, a decrepit and bankrupt edifice ripe for replacement. It didn't work out, as you may have noticed. The book was a bestseller in the United States for a year, which is a long time for a book to be the top of the bestseller list. It was read by every college student. When I was a teenager, you'd go into somebody's dorm room and there would be a copy in paperback of The New Industrial State. And it provoked a furious reaction, a barricading of that rotten door. There followed the rise of old Professor Milton Friedman, of the doctrine of monetarism. A little bit later, the rise to power of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, the Washington Consensus. And by the time that my father passed away in 2006, his book, his big book, was not available. It was out of print. Couldn't buy it. I had a few friends in the United States who said, can I get a copy of this book? And I worked to bring it back into print and succeeded. There are two editions now, one by Princeton, one at the Library of America. It's available. That took a lot of effort at that time. And what is happening here in Russia, and what I saw yesterday with a vast crowd, it was maybe three times back the size of this room, of people there to spend the day talking about the significance of this work, gave me an enormously warm feeling. It's the first major effort to situate this book in the place in our intellectual history that I feel it deserves, but now I know other people, serious people, important professors, and many students of economics here also understand that it deserves. So what was the revolution about? In broad terms, it was about the dominance of the organization over the market, of the business firm as a complex organization, and of the struggle for coordination and control of what my father called the defining role in economics of the planning system. This is not central planning. It's not planning by the central committee, but planning carried out in each complex organization in order to exercise as comprehensive a control as possible over the uncertainties of the economic environment. I don't know if you are students of economics and if you have the standard textbooks and you study the neoclassical theory, then you will know about what my father called the accepted doctrine, the accepted sequence, which is that in the beginning there is the consumer, and the consumer has preferences, makes choices, right? Understands the world of commodities, and has, I see some people nodding, so this is not an unfamiliar view. And the business firm simply produces to meet those needs and adjusts the price so that the market clears, so that there's no unsold surplus. What is that world? That's the world of the 18th century. That's the world of the farm-to-market exchange. That's the world of the farmer bringing his corn or his wheat or his pigs or his sheep and selling them in the village square to the consumer who knows what corn and wheat and pigs and sheep are. That's the market that had existed for 1,000 years before Adam Smith and later maybe Alfred Marshall and others turned it into the central concept of economics. So it was a big job for my father to try and overturn this idea. And what he suggested was there was a revised sequence. That firms start in the modern world with design, with technology, that they see what is possible, and then they conduct market research. They look out and see what they think they can sell. They evaluate what other firms are doing. They take account of what the state will permit. And then they bring in their advertising and their consumer finance staffs and other forces, their distribution networks, to ensure that whatever they produce can be sold and sold at a price that will recover their costs. And that's the objective in the business of the firm. It's not to bring an established commodity to market, but to think of something new, something that you don't have already, but which you can be persuaded to want. This, to my father, was the reality. He didn't think it was a bad thing. He suggested that in a world where we live with complex technologies, which take a long time to develop, require specialized talent, scientific talent, engineering talent, design talent, to bring together, they have to be coordinated, that the market must also be controlled. Otherwise, you have chaos. Otherwise, you have an unacceptably high degree of failure. The products that define modern life, automobiles, jet aircraft, electric power, microchips, cable television, or satellite television, whatever delivers television these days, the internet, cannot be produced except over long lead times and by the integration of these vast networks of different talent. And this is what requires planning. Now, sometimes the planning goes wrong. Sometimes the product fails. Sometimes the company fails. But it doesn't happen too often in a successful system. If Boeing, the aircraft manufacturer, had not understood that its new aircraft, the 787, could be sold, it would never have built it. In fact, it sold them long before it built it. The problem was not selling. The problem was making sure that the airplane actually worked. It's not a good idea to produce airplanes that don't work. Often the business firm replaces the market. They take activities which were previously mediated by purchase and sale and bring it into the corporation. Or they have a relationship with small suppliers and they transfer the risk to their supply chain so that the corporation is stable, but maybe its small suppliers could come and go. Automobile companies do this with auto parts all the time. And people reduce their uncertainty, not by seeing the future. The economists have this idea of perfect foresight. Nobody makes a systematic mistake. And not by diversification, another idea that you diversify your portfolio. But people reduce uncertainty by forming themselves into groups that are large enough to control the future to the extent that they can. These are called countries in politics, in national politics, called parties in politics, in economics, corporations. And so organizations are the central thing that you have to analyze. And once control passes into the organization, it goes there completely. The economics that was developed to describe the small business firm, the owner-entrepreneur, is just obsolete. It may have some stories that you can tell, people inventing things in their garages. But then you look at the history of inventions and you discover it's not like that. Big inventions come out of laboratories, often sponsored by governments. Someone takes them off into a garage and figures out something to do with them. Organizations do not have destinations. They don't maximize. They don't take the shortest path, a little borrowing from classical physics. What organizations have are members. They have participants. They have stakeholders. All, again, with this diversity of talents, interests, and purposes. Decisions are made by committees. My father was fond of a New Yorker cartoon where the people are walking through a park, and on the park, instead of their statues, and the statues don't have equestrians, men on horseback, or political figures declaiming they have groups of people. And the mother says to her small boy, she says, "Son,
In this world there are no more great men, only great committees. Decisions are made by committees. The people who are on top, they have some authority, but it's very limited. They have to get the people beneath them to go along. Individuals no longer matter quite so much. This is not a story of free and independent individual actors. Power in the corporation, in the firm, belongs to a group. Now, my father called it was not his most elegant coinage, the technostructure. The technostructure works for itself. The thing that they want to have happen is for the organization to survive. They want to be able to go to work next week. Right? They want it to continue, a going concern. If they can get that much, which they can agree on, many things are possible. But what must happen is that the minimal interests of all the different groups have to be satisfied, which means that nobody gets everything that they want. Organization is intrinsically a matter of compromise. Who is served depends on who is represented. The standard textbook story, again, many of you have seen it, says, what do businesses do? They maximize profits. Where do profits go? They go to the owners. Shareholder value. That's not what corporations do. And the business school approach to this, which came later, which claimed that they do, it was very destructive to many corporations. What the corporation of the 50s and 60s and 70s generally did was to maximize the interests of the corporation itself. Largely retained its earnings. It established a path of growth. It held market share. It innovated new products and brought them to market. Those owners, the people represented by the board of directors, were not at the table. My father wrote of this, forgive me for quoting one of his more colorful passages, if you think otherwise, you must imagine that a man of vigorous, lusty, and reassuringly heterosexual inclination eschews the lovely and available women by whom he is intimately surrounded in order to maximize the opportunities of other men whose existence he knows of only by hearsay. Not very likely. Years later, this became known in economics as the principal agent problem, but I always thought my father's explanation of it was more colorful. The reach of the planning system and the technostructure extends far beyond this textbook matter of pricing. With considerable, not perfect, but considerable success, firms manage this, what he called the specific demand for the products that they design and sell. What is the specific demand? Well, it's trying to make sure you have a stable market for what you make. What is the great example of the primordial capitalist corporation? The tobacco company. What is the great advantage of the tobacco company? Its product is addictive. Right? Consumers come back to it. Right? That's called a stable market. All you have to do is to persuade a population to start smoking and they'll continue. Right? Until it kills them, of course, which it does in due course. What was the great selling point of the tobacco companies when they industrialized? Well, the original tobacco product, which was a specialty for men, was called the cigar. They were made by hand. They're big, fat things. Right? And when they wanted to sell these products more to a more delicate market, what did they start making and producing by machines? The small cigar, the cigarette. The feminine cigar. The one they could sell to women. It was not by accident. It was a whole population that they had not reached. And suddenly, with industrial means and advertising, they said, okay, this is acceptable for women. And the female population started to smoke. That's called the management of specific demand. Now, that's the canonical case, but you see it in practically every aspect of modern marketing. Look at the way automobiles are designed. You can see the gendering and all kinds of differentiation that is intended to stabilize and expand and control the market share. In most cases, it's not such a terrible thing. Tobacco is a really extreme example. It's not the worst thing in the world. It doesn't, you can't raise it to the level of the maximization of the extraction of surplus value in Marx. So my father wasn't shocked by it. He simply thought this was the way corporations work. And sometimes the customer is the state. And in dealing with the state, especially if what you're selling is advanced weapon systems, you have a very good customer. Stable, has a long time horizon, protects you against loss, is concerned not only about the product, but also about the production system in the way the ordinary customer may not be. More broadly, the planning system forged a consensus around an economic policy goal. It's called economic growth, which became a kind of a holy grail of economic policy from the end of the Second World War up to the turn of the millennium. Why is economic growth important? Because if you have economic growth, then everybody can have a positive profit. It's not a zero-sum game. So all the corporate structures can be reconciled to a degree. The organizational interest can be served. It's the planning system that gives us our devotion to higher education. Emphasis on the generalized business arts, and to some degree the devaluation of higher technical skills, science, mathematics, and engineering, as well as the older talents of design, music, draftsmanship, the fine arts, which I think many people here are dedicated. But you can see the difference between a capitalist economics educational system and one which has its roots in socialism or in some other traditional value structure, in that the capitalist system, its emphasis on business schools, this isn't a business school, is it? I didn't think so. Good, glad to hear it. I could say something deprecating about business schools. Is generating, it's not generating craftsmen, it's not generating people with specific skills or talents. What it needs is flexible young men and women willing to be molded to the goals and to the mores, to the ethics or lack of ethics of the organization, to do what the organization may ask. So the corporation resembles the diplomatic corps or the army and not the medieval guild. Education does not impart skill, as the economists say. What it imparts is acceptability, good way of dressing, showing up on time, appropriate deference to your superiors, appropriate condescension to your subordinates, those kinds of things. The capacity to write a good memo. Now, my father admired Karl Marx, but his work superseded many of the doctrines of Marxian economics because they were geared to a world of affluence, of plenty, whereas Marx wrote in a world of scarcity and deprivation. And planning, where it succeeds, has an effect that even the workers come to identify with the goals of the firm because they're better off inside the firm than outside. So they cooperate to a large extent. Unions tend to lose their vanguard status in that case, that dynamics of class conflict change. There is a need, my father argued, therefore, for new forms of dissent, for new analysis of the social problems. And in particular, to deal with the fact that this system greatly favored the private consumption over the public. This is called the problem of social balance, private affluence and public squalor. The fact that everybody can have the goods they want and still live in an environment where the air can't be breathed, the water can't be drunk, and the parks are soiled and the streets, the sidewalks are not cleaned. So there are environmental, aesthetic, and cultural concerns which will be neglected in the system. I want to speak about his relationship to John Maynard Keynes. Keynes believed in the management of aggregate demand and in the goal objective of full employment. And my father had gone to Cambridge in 1937, didn't meet Keynes there, but had gone and absorbed the general theory shortly after it was published. But once full employment was achieved, Keynes thought that the classical economics of the free market system might apply. You could just let the market decide what was produced and for whom. That wasn't my father's view. He didn't have that illusion. I think the fact that difference owed much to the fact that Keynes did not have a theory of technological change. And my father did. He understood the centrality of technologies to business operations, and therefore that the planning system was a permanent feature of the scene, and the planning system therefore needed to have its own planning framework. And so he was less orthodox even than Keynes. This was a problem. When the new industrial state appeared in 1967, this doctrine of Keynesianism in America was very much in its apex, at its glory. It was fully in control of economic policy. My father's friends and colleagues from Harvard and MIT and Yale were the policy makers in economics. And he saw that they had taken Keynes and had distorted him, and that the planning system had absorbed Keynes and made him an instrument of its own purposes. Economic growth was now the objective, not full employment. Growth serving the corporation, not full employment serving the population. Fluctuations in growth, recessions, would be dealt with immediately by stimulus packages. It was a notion of a trend to which you would try to combat. Growth could be okay, constant, but if it were too rapid, that was a risk because that would bring the unions back. That would bring back a challenge from the workers. So if you generated growth by cutting taxes, not by increasing spending, you kept the state under control, you kept the unions down, you got some growth, enough growth through profits, never enough for real political change. That was the world my father saw in the late 1960s, early 1970s. The world changed. And one of the features of the perspective that I inherited from my father is a belief that there is no economic theory for all time. There is no general doctrine. It wasn't set in stone in the 18th century, the 19th century, or the 20th century. That we are always dealing with a changing situation, and therefore it is not a criticism that any particular author didn't foresee the future. Marx is often denied greatness for having believed that the revolution would triumph everywhere when it didn't. And my father wrote of the corporation when it was at its peak of power, and he didn't fully foresee the problems that would develop. His critics, on the other hand, pretended that corporate power didn't exist. When problems developed, well, this was in a world in which once again, the neoclassical, neoliberal economics was reasserting its primary primacy. But I think that when one begins to focus on the planning system as it was at its peak, you can understand what happened to it and why it declined in the United States and elsewhere. But let me just speak to the American case. The first thing that happened was that there were other countries that had developed their own planning systems which came into the same market space. And in the 1970s, that was Japan, Germany, both of which had grown up in the Second World War with very strong industrial corporations, partly under my father's influence, actually. He was part of the occupation of Germany in 1945. His first encounter with Russians was with the soldiers of the Red Army in Berlin, May, June of 1945. Partly Japan, where he and his students played an important role in the Japanese Reconstruction. Second thing that happened as these companies came in was that the entire industrial system entered a very broad crisis in the early 1980s. And that industrial crisis was brought about by government acting on behalf largely of financial interests. This is the Reagan administration in the United States. I was at that time the staff director of the Joint Economic Committee of the United States Congress. I saw this up close and directly. In the 60s and 70s, corporations didn't need banks very much. They could issue bonds directly. They could fund their investment from their own profits, their retained earnings. And the banking sector was under strict regulatory control. Beginning in the early 1980s, we began to see the restoration of the power of finance capital. This was done by raising interest rates enormously. They were raised to 20% in the early 1980s. The entire industrial system of the United States went into a deep recession. The dollar rose by 60% in value in trade-weighted terms. Imports exploded. Exports collapsed. Market share was lost to Germany and Japan. And the industrial sector lost a great deal of its position. It simply couldn't maintain its previous financial model. One consequence of this was a rise in the willingness to tolerate and the capacity to commit various forms of financial fraud. When you put businesses in the position where they cannot meet their commitments, well, they tend to cheat, to misrepresent their claims for making new loans, and in other ways, making new borrowings, that is to say, and in other ways to undermine the legitimacy and integrity of the order that they are part of. And that too happened beginning in the 1980s and ending up in the early 2000s with some massive corporate scandals, Enron, Tyco, WorldCom, and others, which were of this form and which had the consequence that businesses which followed a traditional and model of balance and integrity were disadvantaged because the markets, which are supposed to be rational and supposed to pick out the honest firms, in fact, always reward the dishonest ones, so long as they aren't detected. Why? Because they grow rapidly. And the sign of rapid growth and high profits is what yields high valuations in the stock market. And you can't tell whether those are real or accounting frauds until someone inside exposes it, or until a shortage of cash causes the firm to collapse. And so the industrial system, having been destabilized by international competition, was further destabilized by a loss of integrity from within. There was something else that happened. And that was that there was a change in the way in which technology is introduced to the business enterprise. Before, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, in the United States, as everywhere in the world, new technologies were a cooperative project between the state and big companies. Bell Labs, a laboratory owned by AT&T, American Telephone and Telegraph, was the inventor of the transistor. The integrated circuit comes out of that. And one could point to any number of innovations in nuclear power and aerospace that are part of this nexus between the state and the big corporation. But with the destabilization of the big corporation, it became, and the return of finance capital, it became possible for the scientists and the engineers, the very top ones, to go form their own companies, which they did, and they moved to California, in between Berkeley and Stanford, Silicon Valley. And they created companies like Fairchild Semiconductor, and a group of companies that were called the Fair Children, right? Which is Intel, and later Apple and Oracle and Microsoft. The companies that form the information sector suddenly become their own corporation. And of course, if you own those companies, then all the capital value goes there, which is why they have such big market valuations in the world. And they become the suppliers of technology to the world industrial firms. So these functions got separated, and you got a technological sector, which was now driven in waves by the financial sector. And you have, of course, an enormous increase in the inequality of the distribution of incomes that results from that. You have people like Bill Gates. Now, who is Bill Gates, and why do we think that he's the richest man in the world? He isn't, by the way. He's the richest man in the world that we know of. And why do we know of him? Because he lives in the United States, and his wealth is the shares of Microsoft that he owns, and we know the price of those shares, so we can figure out what he's worth. He reports it, right? Or he did before he gave it all away to the foundation. It's a difference in another story. Right? Why do we have that phenomenon? Well, a company like that needs to have a figurehead, needs to have someone who's really cool. Bill Gates is a classmate of mine at Harvard. He didn't graduate. I did. It shows you that a Harvard degree isn't worth as much as some people thought it was at the time. But he represents the valuation of a company, and therefore is a symbol of its importance. It doesn't matter whether Bill Gates himself is an important scientific figure, which he isn't. Harvard doesn't produce those. What matters is that he has the money, that he has the shares, and can act as a very good advertisement for the importance of his firm. In the course of these transformations, the technostructure evolved. The new economy, as we came to call it, had a different shape and a different balance of power. It had a new role for the investment banker, for the hedge fund manager, for the financial raider. Less stability, that was true in the 1960s. It was centered also in other parts of the United States. In particular, the old industrial corporation was a creature of the Midwest and the upper Midwest, the Great Lakes region. The new technology and finance was a coastal phenomenon. New York for finance and California, Washington State for technology.
And the technostructure that developed in that those sectors became part of a governing professional class in the 1990s. A governing professional class that did not have the full interests of the country in mind, but was serving ultimately largely its own interests and its own geographic base and its own sectoral base, finance and technology. We built an obsession, an unbalanced obsession around these sectors. And the result of that, ultimately, is in front of us today. It's in front of us today. The result of that was a rebellion that expressed itself in politics against a permanent government of the professional classes. I don't live on the East Coast. I don't live on the West Coast. I can see this very clearly. We have a rebellion. The visible symptom and symbol of that rebellion, who is it? It's Donald Trump. That's what we're seeing. So we're seeing a very interesting consequence of this distorted destabilization and evolution of the American corporate sector. So what have we now? We have a situation in which the rule of the bureaucrats and the technocrats and the lawyers and the investment bankers and so forth has largely been overthrown. And it's been replaced by the direct rule of, to borrow a phrase from this country, a word from this country, the great oligarchs. The direct rule of big business. A cabinet of billionaires drawn from oil and insurance and pharmaceuticals, other places, interspersed with generals of the Marine Corps, a different professional group, and led by a specialist in hotels and casinos, a businessman who is exactly the opposite of an organization man. A one-man band of American business has become the president of the United States. This is a very interesting experiment. Very uncomfortable experiment. It's a very interesting one. Because it asks a question. Can a society which is as complex as the modern industrial state actually function if its leadership truly not only does not know, but does not care, does not have any interest in the technical aspects of how it actually runs, and in fact is hostile to the people who have been making it run for the last 50 years. That's the situation we're in. True in healthcare, true in education, true in energy, true in all scientific matters, true in relation to the challenges of climate change, true in with respect to the national defense, true with respect to the regulation of finance, true with respect to practically every other technical function that the government has. Now, the people who are actually doing the work are still there, but there's nobody sitting over them who understands or appreciates their function. Huh? We've seen one consequence of that last week, which was that the effort to, on the part of the Republican leadership in the House of Representatives, to change our health care laws, failed because they couldn't put together a piece of legislation that coherently assembled the necessary votes in the Republican Party. A friend of mine referred to this bill as a dumpster fire of legislation. That's not a compliment. Now, you can see one consequence then is that these processes of decision making are breaking down. I think my father would not have been surprised
And he would have thought that what will happen is that in due course, real power will come to be exercised, at least in a continuing way, by those who are in the lower ranking positions and entrusted with keeping things going on a day-to-day basis. And maybe the government isn't necessary at all for that. I would think that estimate of the situation might be a trifle optimistic. My father was an optimist. I'm not. And I would suggest that precisely because we have structures of the state which are at war with the planning system that was described 50 years ago in my father's book, New Industrial State, we have now something which might be called the Predator State. That's the title of a book that I published in 2008. A state where the top actors are mainly interested in gaining some advantage for their friends or themselves from the exercise of state functions. I would suggest that in such a situation, any government is running the risk of a calamity, is running the risk that after a certain amount of time, the population will decide that this just isn't functioning anymore. And when that happens, anything can happen. I don't want to exaggerate too much, but since you live here, you understand the situation. I would offer the suggestion that no country survives the departure of even its smallest members. It was the Baltics that left the Soviet Union first. It was Slovenia that left Yugoslavia first. And it was South Carolina in 1860 that left the United States, a state which was described at the time as too small for a republic and too large for an insane asylum. The United States is tied together in some very serious ways. But unless it comes to grips with its problems, I don't think anything is immune from ultimately changing the way people view the structure of the country as a whole. Thank you very much.